Hello and welcome to another episode of The Grey Natal. It's a loose discussion of travel, adventure, diving, driving gear, and most certainly watches. This is episode 278, and it's proudly brought to you by the always growing TGN supporter crew. We thank you all so much for your continued support, and if you're listening and you would like to support the show, please visit thegreynatal.com for more details. My name is James Stacey, and I'm joined as ever by my friend and co-host Jason Heaton. Hey Jason, how's it going there?
Pretty snowy, actually. Yeah, we're getting, it's better, I guess I'd say better late than never, but I think it's a little too late in my eyes for winter's arrival here at the very tail end of March. But I think it'll be gone by the end of the week if temperatures hold like they've been all winter. So, but other than that, yeah, doing fine.
Yeah, I mean, same here. I mean, we were on the other side of some drama in the Slack, which I guess is what we can get into. I figure most people on the Slack, you know, it's 1,500 or so of you that are listening, definitely asked for us to talk about this.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, we, you know, after 2.5 years of basically operating, not largely on good faith, but just being making a nice, kind, you know, sort of walled garden, we had someone come in and decide to try and take advantage of a few folks in the sales forum, and it's been a bit of a learning lesson for Jason and I. You know, we're learning as we go, and want to offer a big shout out to Chris Soule, our moderator. You know, we should hear from Chris Soule on the show pretty soon, but yeah, it was kind of an interesting experience. Jason, I don't know if you, because I caught up a little late. Like, I was probably an hour behind when things were recognized, but basically the easy thing is we're not going to say the guy's name. It's been handled. He won't be back on the Slack. We'll get to the resolution in just a few minutes, but we had a problem with this person kind of just not operating in good faith or being kind, kind of being dodgy, that sort of thing in the BST. That's the buy sell trade channel on our Slack. And also, just kind of in general, like we had some reports. He kind of butted heads with a few people and that sort of thing. So he was kind of already on. It's not like we have a strike system or whatever, but he was on our radar, right?
Yeah, he'd kind of run afoul of a few of our kind of guidelines or rules that we have. We have kind of a simple set of buy sell trade rules in terms of how you post watches or other items that you want to sell, and he was defying some of those rules and giving a few warnings, and yeah, he would correct them in some cases and others not. And, you know, in retrospect, I suppose we might have been a little too lenient on those cases, but then things sort of came to a head when he actually did scam a few of our members and basically sold them on watches that he had no intention of delivering, and kind of, yeah, took the money and ran, as they say, which kicked us all into high gear and jumped on it.
Yeah, I get a message from you and I'm kind of like, wait, what is this about? And you're like, just check the Slack. Yeah. Like, what are you doing? Yeah. And so I go on the Slack and like, yeah, so we had a number of users basically say that they had active deals going on with this party, and then suddenly his account was gone.
Yeah.
Had deleted his account. We had very little, like, you know, information from Slack. They give you nothing. Substack gives you even less than nothing, presumably for privacy concerns and that sort of thing. So we started collecting data. I wanted to try and understand the problem as best as possible. It's not my first time. I've personally been scammed and messed with on Watch You Seek and other sort of forms. Sometimes it kind of comes with the zone and you could just kind of deal with it and hopefully you didn't put money into the world. But sadly, we had, you know, 8 or 9 people who had put some money into this space. Luckily, not giant sums, mm-hmm, but nevertheless, money.
Yeah.
Right. And obviously, this is very stressful for Jason and I because people pay for the Slack. And we've run essentially 2.5 years with almost no problems. Everybody's on very much the same wavelength. And then you have some sort of a bad operator, somebody coming in bad faith. And so we did what we could to kind of understand what the scope was, how much money we're talking about, how many people, that sort of thing, and what the methodology was. And in the process, the Slack itself, everybody on the Slack just started chiming in, wanting to help or support or offer data that they had from a interaction with this fella previously. He had some positive or like some normal quality sales, buying and selling on the Slack previously. So I can't imagine that this dude signed up on the Slack with the express goal of scamming people, because if he did, he's just an idiot.
Yeah.
We had his name, we had his address, we had his phone number. The Google, with those things, Google really lets you go nuts on people. So I had devoted some time to trying to understand what I could about this fella. There is always some risk, and that's fine. We're okay with there being some risk. We just don't want the Slack to be more risky than, say, using WatchUSeek or Reddit or those sorts of stuff. So obviously there are a few things that we need to change about the kind of rules, regulations, and reliability index, the way in which you can kind of have some confidence in who's actually buying or selling a watch. And those updates are coming. This episode comes out on Thursday, and by Friday we're planning to relaunch BST with new protections in place. So it'll be a little bit more difficult to get going, and there'll be a few more hoops to jump through in the process, but that's definitely on our radar. And that was largely our main goal. We wanted to do what we could to make the affected parties whole, whether that be them being able to claim their money back or some other option. And then the other side was we wanted to make sure that we put whatever plans we could in place so that this couldn't happen again, or if it was actively happening again, people would have a set of rules and guidelines to help protect them from this sort of behavior. So those are in process. If you're listening to this right away on Thursday, those are in process and will be implemented shortly. And if you're getting to this episode a few days later, they're already up and running. Please read the guide in BST if you're interested. I think it's still a great place to buy and sell watches. We've had a huge number of, I mean, these few sales don't even represent an aggregate of a percent in terms of the number of sales that have gone through there. But we're going through this whole process, and you know, I've got the fellow's email address, I've got his phone number, we know his address, that sort of thing. And I kind of like, I calm down. I don't make great decisions when I'm angry, and I was pretty angry and stressed about this whole scenario for a couple days. And then, I don't know, maybe 2 days, 2-3 days after it happened, we just figured we'd reach out.
Yeah.
Just to see, like we wanted to be 100% sure that this wasn't like his account got hacked, mm-hmm. or, you know, he agreed to a few sales and then something terrible happened in his life and he went offline. I mean, the deleting the Slack account is pretty clear, but you want to be sure. And let's be clear, I'm not a tough guy, and I genuinely don't play one on the internet or even our Slack. Our Slack, the thread was several hundred messages, and when we get to the outcome, people really gave me a lot of credit for muscling my way into this guy's world, and I really didn't. The message was very benign. Arguably, I genuinely believe that threats on the internet are valueless. They don't do anything. Your best chance in a scenario like this is to appeal to someone's reason or their sense of self-protection, which was the goal with my message. And I, you know, simply said, you know, it looks like this has happened. Would love to get your side of the story. But also, everyone who's affected, who can no longer reach you anymore, is speaking with the FBI via, and like I shared the same link that we shared with everybody who was affected by the cyber crime thing that the FBI, where you can report a complaint. And I sent the Instagram, I sent a DM on Instagram because this guy followed me on Instagram. Such a weird criminal. And he saw it and blocked me. And I was like, all right, well, he saw it. And I got a response. And I figured, I'll spend the next couple hours just kind of bothering him. Not mean, like not being mean or like threatening in any way, just like a nuisance. Did the same thing to his email, maybe with a little bit more detail about what was going on and kind of where I saw this going. If he didn't make some sort of option. And the whole thing I was just asking for is like, your best case here, because it's not enough money to change your life. The best case here is just to refund it.
Yeah.
And try and make these folks whole to kind of lower the damage that could be done, you know, in the future. And then sent the email, maybe a half hour later, sent a text message with the same sort of data directly to his phone. Kind of left it at that, and then went on, and a few minutes later, people started getting their refunds. So he ended up refunding all of the money that he took. And such an there was no way he had a plan.
Yeah.
In all of this, I don't really get it. But it definitely wasn't something that felt super thoughtful. But in the end, as it sorted out, everybody got their money back, which is I don't know that there's a better outcome. I mean, the better outcome would have been this didn't happen at all. But we can't always adjust for every single person being sweet and understanding and not a predator. And so with that, you know, kind of constraint in mind, I think that a refund is kind of your best possible outcome to this scenario. And everybody got their money back, and we'll tune up the rules for BST. But I thought folks might enjoy a little bit of the background. As much as I really love the memes on Slack about me being a tough guy. You know, I was compared to several of my favorite characters from Heat, which is just a very high moment for me in a very stressful week. I genuinely believe at times zero threat is somewhat more menacing than a threat when you're expecting one. In this one scenario, it worked out in our favor. So I'm very thankful.
Yeah, it was definitely a cautionary tale for everybody that buys and sells watches on the internet, and especially in our...
Or buys and sells anything on the internet.
Yeah, and our you know, our Slack group is largely run on goodwill and a sense of community, and so this sent a bit of a reverberation through the community, and
yeah,
everybody was understandably kind of shaken by it. But then I think on the other side of the coin, it really demonstrated the strength of our community in how many people came forward to, you know, give information, give advice, yep, countless people offering to help reimburse those affected.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we all kind of leaped into action. Those of us kind of behind the scenes to kind of reconfigure how we're going to relaunch Buy Sell Trade. We pulled it down, of course. It's as we mentioned, it'll be back up tomorrow as you're listening to this on a Thursday. Yeah, I mean, all things considered, I think it was a good outcome. And you know, you mentioned the FBI, and I think, you know, beyond the threat of contacting the FBI, as kind of a public service announcement, we can direct people that if you are affected, you know, hopefully not in the future on our TGN Slack buy sell trade, but anywhere, you can go to IC3.gov, which is the FBI's Internet Crime Complaint Center. And allegedly they do take this stuff seriously, and they do look into complaints. And so there's a button right on that page that says file a complaint. You can go through and fill that stuff out. So we do encourage people that, you know, if you are affected anywhere on the internet with things you're buying or selling, to give that a look. And it certainly worked in our favor, at least as a sort of a deterrent, I guess, or some sort of a mild threat, if you want to call it that.
Yeah, I mean, it was a bummer that it happened in the first place, and I genuinely feel bad for like the stress that it brought on the folks that were financially affected by the outcome. And certainly it was a stressful couple of days for you and me and Chris, and you know, we're actually expanding the moderator team. We'll have more news on that in the future, just to just to grow confidence in the platform. The one thing that I'm more sure of than ever, and I was already, I thought, 100% sure, but it's just, this is the best group of folks in the watch world.
Yeah,
all together, all hanging out, all having a good time. And you know, we had one fraction of a percent of the population decided that they would take advantage of folks' kind of goodwill and trusting nature, and it didn't work out in the end, which feels like a win for us and for, you know, rational, thoughtful human beings. But I guess it's a shout out to say that if you're on the Slack and were involved in this process, whether it was providing feedback, whether it was offering to do the GoFundMe thing, whatever layer, just a big thank you from Jason and I and Chris. The community is incredible. You guys are so much fun. And, you know, I don't care about a lot of things, if I'm really honest, in my life, but I care pretty fiercely about TGN. And the core of TGN has, in the last couple of years, become this Slack. Mm-hmm. And it was really interesting and kind of heartwarming in a non-internet sort of way to see the way that folks kind of responded to this. You know, we said for a long time that this feels like being on a watch group 10 years ago online.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like we got another real slice of that here, where it luckily, you know, it worked out the way it worked out, and I'm happy with that. I'm happy with how we handled things, but I'm just really impressed by this group. So I did want to give that a bit of a highlight and let people know that we took it really seriously. You know, BST was brought down almost immediately. We addressed from every angle the sort of scenario, and in the end, it worked out. I don't know if it will work out like that again in the future, but hopefully we should have more checks and balances in place to prevent the sort of predatory behavior that happened. So
yeah,
that's the outcome. I'm thrilled to say that it was positive, and it was a really nice highlight of all the great things that this community has kind of brought upon itself. You know, I don't think Jason and I can take much credit for it. It doesn't take much work to turn on a Slack. It does take a lot of work for people to, for a whole community kind of hang out and be on the same wavelength. So we can take one small fraction of that credit, I suppose, and the rest for all of you.
Yeah, so true. And here's hoping we have a quieter week this week. So far, so good. I mean, I think at least I know for you, you're neck deep in Watches and Wonders prep, and to a certain degree, I guess I'm also working through kind of scheduling and that sort of thing. There's a concurrent show in Geneva running alongside Watches and Wonders called awkwardly named Time to Watches with a number of other brands. And so that's sort of putting some complications.
It's a good show. It's a dumb name, but it's a great show. Zen is there. Marathon is there. There's a bunch of great. It's a huge hall, and it's like visiting a small show. I highly recommend it if you're in town, but it is a weird name. It's always been a weird name.
So, yeah, you know, here we are recording on a Tuesday. The our kind of Slack drama died off last Friday, which made for a more relieved weekend for us, certainly. Mm-hmm. But yeah, here we are, you know, moving forward in a calmer week, a happier state of mind. And yeah, I guess other than that, it was a couple of months ago. I was asked to contribute, kind of do a Q&A session with Giant Mouse Knives for their blog on their website. They call it Knife Styles. It's their journal. And it was kind of a Q&A about, you know, my work and kind of my history and adventuring and diving and that sort of stuff, as well as kind of my history with knives, obviously, given that Giant Mouse is a knife company. And our good buddy Jim Wirth is a active member of our Slack community and a longtime listener. We've met him at Windup, just an all-around great guy. Jim, in kind of concert with my appearance on the Knife Styles Journal, has kindly offered a 25% discount on Giant Mouse Knives to TGN listeners, which runs now. Actually, it's active now as we're recording this, but he extended it through Sunday for those of you that are catching up and, you know, listening on a Thursday, Friday, or Saturday, or Sunday. And you can use the code all caps TGN25OFF, O-F-F,
nice,
for 25% off. And that's a really nice deal. You know, you and I are both fans of Giant Mouse, and Jim has offered discounts in the past to our group and has kindly offered it again. So thanks for that, Jim, and to Giant Mouse. And thanks for having me on the Journal. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, the Journal thing's really cool. The knives are incredible. You know, I've been a lifelong knife nerd. And when you get past some of the big store brands, you end up into brands like Giant Mouse. The designs are great. I've got a couple of their knives here. I also really like, as much as I love the knives, and I do, and I like to carry a knife as much as possible, obviously you can't when you travel, and you can't if you're going certain places, concerts, or, you know, just places where knives are inappropriate, especially within, say, the Canadian context here. It's different depending on where you live, of course. But the one that I carry all the time, which I got at Windup just last year, is the Giant Mouse Cap Lifter / Pry Bar.
Yeah.
And they make these in a few different materials. I have the one in like a brushed titanium, and I absolutely love this thing. It has obviously a cap lifter, as it says, and it's a little bit of a pry bar. It has like a bit of a grip on one side, and then it has like a little channel that you can hook into a belt loop or a strap and loop your keys into it so it can kind of hold it in certain places. I really like this. I have it with me most of the time. The pry bar is enough of an edge to cut right into an Amazon package, like what I would normally be using a knife for anyways.
Yeah,
they just make awesome stuff, and Jim and Giant Mouse are not only active elements in the greater community, they're at Windup. Jim's a huge watch guy. They have a great staff, but also the product is killer, and he's been, you know, part of the TGN crew and supporting that for a long time. So a good shout out, and always keen to offer a little discount. So you can't complain on that front.
Definitely.
25% is awesome.
Yeah. Well, I touched on Watches and Wonders and kind of our prep and getting ready for that in a couple of weeks. That's our topic for today. But before we jump into it, let's do a quick wrist check.
Yeah, what have you got on?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, it's kind of an interesting segue. It's not Watches and Wonders related, but today I'm wearing my Blancpain 50 Fathoms, the big 45 millimeter titanium one that I've had for just over a year. I got it last year before I went to French Polynesia with Blancpain. But I kind of wore it in honor of last week's big launch of a 42 millimeter version of the same watch, as well as a gold version in both blue and black dials. And this was, this kind of took the watch world by storm. I think everybody was sort of waiting for a watch. You know, they had the Act One last year, which was a 42 millimeter in steel. But as the owner of a 45 millimeter titanium, I can say the comfort of it, even on this big size, is tremendous. And I can imagine that the 42 millimeters even more so.
Yeah, I got a chance to see these when I was in New York. Mm-hmm. I swung by the office during over March break, and Mark Kosler, it's my coworker and easily one of the greatest watch photographers alive currently, he was shooting the watch, and I grabbed the black version and the blue on the bracelet. The black one on the Tropic strap is pretty great. I think what you'd kind of assume.
Yeah.
It's a little thick, right? They're just shy of 15 millimeters, which, you know, feels thick, but because the titanium, On a strap, it didn't feel so bad. It felt a little bit bulkier on the titanium bracelet, which is an option, I guess. You know, you still get a date at 4:30, and it's a it's a canted date, so it aligns with the alignment of the marker rather than the natural alignment of the dial, which is, you know, something we've been talking about with those new Seikos. Mm-hmm. It's how much we like the fact that they rotate the date display so it aligns with the rest of the text on the dial. Blancpain doesn't do that here. Bezel action was really good. Legibility is great. It just looks like a 50 fathoms, but it's a touch smaller, which I think is super smart. You know, we don't typically get into, like, not arguments, but like major discourse over pricing on a brand new watch. Mm-hmm. I'm much more interested in pricing in the real world, like in secondary markets and that sort of thing. What do you think of this? I think we're talking $16,600. To me, that struck as actually high.
Yeah, I mean, it's, well, the 45 millimeter that I have, that, you know, just in full transparency, I was given by Blancpain as a gift for moderating a panel that I did in French Polynesia last year for them, is an $18,000 watch. So, you know, more, I guess, if you're looking at the 42, obviously it's going to be less. It's a smaller watch. It's high. I mean, no matter which way you look at it. We did talk to Mark Hayek when we interviewed him last year about the possibility of Blancpain doing a more affordable version of a 50 fathoms for those of us that have been kind of craving that, and kind of a throwback to their history making everyman dive watches, so to speak. He said that's probably not in the cards given the brand's positioning. And I suppose, you know, the movements are very impressive. These are 120-hour power reserve, in-house, anti-magnetic, et cetera, et cetera. So these are high-end watches with great finishing. But 16,000 is expensive. Yeah, that's it's not a cheap watch.
I don't know why, but I thought that, like, if you're going to do one, and maybe they have another one in the future, maybe one that's a little bit more simple in some metric. And to be honest, maybe the more simple option is the Bathyscaphe. Mm-hmm. You know, offhand, I don't know the exact pricing of the current Bathyscaphe range, but that includes everything from a smaller diver with a date all the way up to like a triple calendar diver. It's a strange line of watches. It's cool. I am very much a fan of the Bathyscaphe stuff. But yeah, I thought 16.6 felt like a lot. I would have thought they would want to go a little bit closer to the natural home of like the price point for the Submariner. Mm-hmm. Obviously, yeah, the movement, you're getting a 5-day power reserve. It's a 4 hertz movement. And to be fair, I said it was close to 15. These fractions do matter to people. It's 14.2. So it's much closer to 14 than 15. But that is a little on the thick side for a dive watch with a date these days. It's, you know, considerably thicker than, say, a Submariner, or if you're going titanium for titanium, it's, you know, considerably thicker than a Pelagos 39, for example. But I think they're gorgeous. This is obviously a style that I really like in general. I think it'll be fun to see how these are received, how they kind of hit the market in the secondary pricing, like what they cost used, if you wanted to go that route. But I think the sizing works really well. The 42, I would actually say, and you can see the pictures on Mark's wrist, his wrist is, I think, a little bit bigger than mine, and it doesn't even look like 42. It's a nicely balanced thing. It has these weird 21.5 millimeter lugs. But of course, I think at 0.5, you can probably fit any 22 mil strap you've got. It's just, it would be a concern more for the bracelet, which would be very specific. So I think the lug sizing is weird, but in person, is it going to matter? I don't know. Probably not. Especially if you're buying it on the bracelet and wearing it on the bracelet, the lug width doesn't make any difference at all. For me, a NATO nerd, it would make some difference, but I know a 22 would look just fine in a 21.5. Mm-hmm. I'm on record. I would love to one day own a 50 fathoms. I think in my mind, I still want something closer to like the mil spec tribute that Hodinkee did and you know, previous to that Blancpain did all on their own. Those speak to me a little bit more concretely, but I do think that these just, they look really good. It's worth checking them out just for the photos if you happen to miss that news.
Yeah, that was kind of big news last week. And certainly they sneaked that in just ahead of Watches and Wonders. You know, a few brands kind of come out with new watches to kind of capitalize on the heightened attention around this time of year.
Yeah, definitely.
Speaking of brands we'll be seeing in Geneva, Doxa is not at Watches and Wonders, but they are kind of taking appointments, I guess you'd say, at the one of the hotels in Geneva. And we both will be seeing that. Pretty excited for that. Looks like that's what you've got on today.
Yeah, today I've got my Sub 300, the anniversary Sea Rambler. I for whatever reason, I think we were talking about watches on a recent Q&A maybe, and the Doxa thing came up, and I was like, it's been a little bit too long since I wore that, and I've been wearing it for a few days. I just love it. It's great. You know, I looking over their lineup and preparing for what we might see at Watches and Wonders released. You know, I was looking at the other colorways. I still really love the SR, but I something in a Shark Hunter I think would be pretty fun too at some point. You know, having owned a Pro and an SR, I also just have such a fondness for the yellow. It's a great yellow.
Yeah, yeah.
You can tell I didn't have a ton more to say about this watch, so we've already devolved down to just general Doxa colors.
Well, I feel like you know, the Sea Rambler, in particular, it feels like the most nostalgic of kind of the Doxa subs.
Yeah.
For some reason, that sort of silvery dial always makes me think of late 60s, early 70s kind of, you know, Kodachrome images from, you know, dive expeditions, Stan Waterman, et cetera.
Totally.
And it's also a very summery watch. I mean, we were just talking about the kind of rotten winter weather that we're getting late here in March. And, you know, maybe you're wearing that. We'll will some warmer, summery weather to arrive soon.
I can't wait. It is a little warmer here this week, so maybe I'll take the credit for that and give it to the Doxa. So, but yeah, that's what I had on, and that, I guess that brings us right into a discussion of what's coming up for Watches and Wonders. So, you know, in the past we've done different versions of these sort of prediction ones. The truth is that I pretty much know at this point. I think I know what almost every brand is launching, except for three brands, which is Tudor, Rolex, and Patek. Patek, I think, is kind of outside the scope of TGN for the most part, and it's difficult to guess. There's just so much going on with that brand. They can come from kind of any... Look at what they launched last year and try and guess this year. Good luck. But we always have a good time with Rolex and Tudor. Tudor's very deeply a TGN sort of core sort of concern. So we figured we would do you know, we've got a few predictions each of things that we think that are possible, and then we've each come up with kind of a wish that, you know, if we could, you know, maybe run the brand for a day or get what we were hoping for, that would be the wish segment. So, Jason, you want to kick it off with Rolex or Tudor?
Yeah, let's start with Rolex. Yeah, it's fun.
All right, so give me a prediction for Rolex 2024. I get worse at this the more years I've been doing this. Last year, I wasn't close on any metric. I don't know that anyone guessed balloon dial, date just, or whatever, but still.
Yeah, I mean, I know that, you know, Rolex kind of did some wacky stuff with jigsaw puzzles and different colors and that sort of stuff in the past. And, you know, odds are we'll see some other sort of funky, colorful thing from them this year, which feels so not Rolex, but nowadays it sort of does. But last year also saw the introduction of their 1908 collection, which was a bit of a surprise for a lot of people. It was sort of a throwback to Rolex dress watches of the past. They got rid of the Cellini name, the Cellini line of small, rather beautiful dress watches, but not the first thing that comes to mind when you think of Rolex. And they introduced this 1908 collection. And I kind of see them expanding that. I think they'd be kind of crazy. In fact, I would say this is probably my most confident prediction that we'll see something else in the 1908 line. And specifically, this might be more of a, I don't want to call it a wish, but this might be a bit more of a long shot. They might just do stuff with sizes and dial colors and things like that. But
yeah,
I would love to see them do like an annual calendar moon phase in that watch.
Like some, you know, is there a real complication?
Yeah, like a complication in that case, yeah, with that dial. And I think it would be a perfect fit. I think it'd be a hot seller. I think, you know, collectors would really go for that, especially if it was smaller. The 1908, the one that they released, I believe was 39 millimeters last year. You know, something a little smaller would be neat. But I think also that 39 millimeter that they came out with, if I had one gripe about it, was for the type of watch it is, it felt a little too expansive across the dial. And I think filling that space with, you know, a beautiful moon phase display, maybe annual calendar, you know, apertures in the dial, I think would fill up some of that space and look really sharp. This isn't a watch that's in my wheelhouse by any means, for more reasons than one, but I do find it quite a bewitching watch to look at. I do like the look of it, and I'd love to see them do a complicated version of it.
Yeah, I don't disagree. You know, I think it's interesting because it's a brand that people don't necessarily think of for moon phases.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is, of course, you had the 8171, the Patalone, that was quite famous with that, and still remains like super rare, super collectible, very special sort of watch with a great moon phase. And then there was a modern Cellini from just a few years ago that also had the moon phase. So I think that could happen, you know, and it would make sense for them to, because they, you know, theoretically it could be the same or very similar movement. Mm-hmm. That to what they were using previously. So yeah, I like that pick, and I think it's possible. I think it would be cool to see. Last year they did the simple dress watch version, and then this year, yeah, if they went annual calendar, if they went even further, or who knows? Like, but I think something cool in the 1908, like something to really establish it as a watch for someone who loves watchmaking, yeah, rather than a watch for someone who wants a dressy Rolex.
Right, right.
Yeah, I think that's a good one, an interesting pick for sure.
Yeah, all right.
Let's see. My first prediction for Rolex is I think we will see a slight massaging of the current Explorer 2.
Oh.
So I don't think we're going to see new dials. I don't think we'll see a carbon. I don't think we'll see a RLX. They're, you know, the brand's titanium, but I think we might see it come to 41 millimeters to align with the Submariner and you know, kind of more closely unify the overall like specs and offering of the professional lineup.
Yeah.
It seems to be something they've been doing over the last few years, is just kind of slowly massaging stuff to a similar case size for the core lines. And the Explorer 2 is always the sort of outlier to what the brand is up to. I mean, like, if we're getting into wishes, we could go a different direction with the Explorer 2. I do think this would be an interesting home for titanium for the brand.
Oh yeah.
Being that it is a sporty watch, and it is a watch that's very different from the Submariner and the Daytona.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that would be kind of my first prediction. A very easy one. I think that we'll see a slight... I think we'll still have the big orange hand. I think it'll be a white and a black dial, the big maxi markers, all that kind of stuff. But I think we'll have a sort of adjustment of the proportions, you know, moving forward.
That's a good prediction, I think. And it's a very Rolex prediction, or it would be a very Rolex move. You know, they're known for, you know, everybody kind of has this high anticipation. Then they go to a meeting and they're like, we've slightly trimmed down the lugs, mm-hmm, and added a bit of a bevel here. And it's like everybody's kind of looking, yep, and looking and looking, and then, oh yeah, I kind of see it. But yeah, you're right. That's a good call. Yeah.
You know, and last year was a big year for both Tudor and Rolex in terms of news and, mm-hmm, and impact of the new product and the stories and the conversations around the celebration dial, around the jigsaw dial, around the BB54. And I would expect them, I think it would be acceptable if they had something like of a more quiet year or a slower year as far, yeah, as a giant release. If I was them, I'd be saving the big release for September. Mm-hmm. If Tudor's kind of big move currently is F1 with the RB Visa Cash App team, then, you know, closer to the end of the championship, you could see something, I think. Granted, Tudor's very difficult to pull on, and they don't typically operate within the confines of partnerships. Mm-hmm. They could release something now and just have it actually hit the market closer to the end. So I don't think that the brands run on the same strategy necessarily, but that is kind of what I'm thinking is sort of a massaging of the Explorer 2. What do you figure for another Rolex prediction?
Yeah, I've got, this is a, I guess you could call it a wish more than a prediction. My confidence is fairly low that this would actually come to pass, but I have seen, on the interwebs, a few kind of mock-up photos of a white dial Explorer 1, you know, just a 36 millimeter Explorer, oh, yeah, with a white dial. I think it would look sharp. I know that, you know, I do like the look of white dial Rolexes in general. Certainly your Explorer 2.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, when they've done, you know, Oyster Perpetuals and things in lighter colored dials, it just looks great. And I think an Explorer with those big, bold numerals with a white dial would be really sharp. And I think it would add a dimension to that family of watches that would draw in some people that maybe, well, like myself, find the Explorer a little too sober, a little too kind of predictable, boring, if you want to use that word. I think a white dial would kind of give that family a little bit of a zing. But again, I wouldn't hold my breath. I think that might be a real long shot as opposed to my first prediction.
Yeah, I think that's a good one. I mean, I think it's one of those things where people would absolutely love to see it. It's probably right on the line between a prediction and a wish.
Yeah.
I think if that was on the horizon, we might have already seen it leak.
Oh,
you know what,
yeah,
I mean?
Right. That's true.
Just, you know, the retailers, you know, we're recording this on March 26th. I assume some retailers are seeing the product, mm-hmm, the new product roadmap this week, next week.
Yeah.
And that's usually where the leaks come from. I don't usually love the leaks because I think in the last couple of years, we've also had people who like doctored the leak. My final prediction, again, not like blowing it out in any way. I think we'll see a new color for the GMT.
Hmm.
Whether it's a new version of the black, or maybe it's the green black of the left hand, but now in a right hand, something like that.
Oh, yeah.
They did the two-tone and the solid gold last year. I could see that with a different bezel color instead of the black gray.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe just another bezel option. I think a solid gold with the Pepsi bezel would be pretty rad, right?
Yeah. What about a Coke?
Or a Coke, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It hasn't, we haven't had a Coke proper since the 16710.
Yeah.
And I think I don't think it matters what color they pick. Mm-hmm. They will sell all of them. These are just, it's a great watch if you can get it for what Rolex says the price is.
Yeah.
It's really hard to disagree with the everything of a modern GMT Master. Probably my favorite six digit Rolex these days.
Yeah.
They fit really well. They look great. I'm not a Batman guy deep down, the blue black, but I like the, the previous black bezel with the green GMT hand. And, I've appreciated the newer versions as they've come out. But I think we could see another, let's call it a color extension of the GMT. Again, not like a super exciting prediction.
Sure.
But this is kind of where I think the brand might go this year.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. All right. I've got a big wish. This is a big wish. It is absolutely not going to happen. All right. Actually, before I say that, one thing I was looking at before we started talking today was, I was looking to see what anniversaries Rolex might be able to celebrate this year in terms of, I guess it would be 1954, 64, 74, et cetera. Couldn't really find anything significant unless you look at the 1954 Basel World, which I think officially was the year that they introduced the Submariner at Basel World. But regardless, didn't find anything. But I was thinking back to the 70s and I was like, wouldn't it be cool if Rolex surprised everybody and launched a new Oyster Quartz? A date just Oyster Quartz with that integrated bracelet style that is so hot these days from so many brands, from Tissot to Chopard to IWC and Audemars Piguet, etc. Something like that, like a more kind of edgy 70s-ish date just with a high precision quartz movement in it. I think it'd be so hot. I think it'd be so cool. I mean, we're both fans of quartz watches in general. And I think high accuracy quartz, whether it's from Citizen or Seiko or, Grand Seiko, are just really cool. Breitling, et cetera. I think the return of an Oyster Quartz might have a bit of traction, at least among, enthusiasts and nerds. So anyway, I don't think it'll happen. It's a major wish with a capital W, but there you have it.
Yeah, I think that's a fun choice. It's also like on paper, if you didn't know the history of the Oyster Quartz from 1977, you wouldn't know its connection to some very TGN sort of endeavors. The Oyster Quartz was worn by Peter Habler and Reinhold Messner when they did their first unsupported, no oxygen push in 78 of Everest. Which is a pretty cool backstory for a quartz watch and for a guy, that's largely known for wearing a 1655 and those great photos and that incredible hair and all this kind of stuff. And I love the idea of a new Oyster Quartz. If they do it, it would be an interesting way for Rolex to enter the sort of integrated bracelet space.
Yeah.
If they wanted to follow the impetus of the original, but in a way that's deeply not a Patek or a Chopard, being a quartz movement. I think that's a fun, super fun idea. I don't think we'll see it. That would be like a big surprise.
Yeah.
But at least it'd be fun to write about.
Right. You know
what I mean? Whereas totally. Like the two things I mentioned, like we'll cover it for sure. Whatever comes out, we're writing about it. But like a slightly massaged Explorer 2 and some new colors for a GMT aren't as exciting as a brand new quartz integrated bracelet sports watch from Rolex.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
And then when it comes to my wish for Rolex, it's actually just for them to take what I think is probably my favorite feature set on a Rolex currently and put it in a slightly smaller watch. And that would be like a 36 to 40 millimeter Skydweller.
Mm.
So I absolutely adore the Skydweller. They're expensive because they're either mixed or fully precious metal.
Yeah.
But the actual functionality, which I think most people didn't do enough reading when the watch came out to even understand what it does and how it works with the turnable bezel, like the bezel is essentially a switch or coordinating switch for the annual calendar and for the ability to jump time zones.
Yeah.
And I think fitting that functionality into something that at a distance could be worn like a Datejust would be awesome.
Yeah.
The current is 42 millimeters. It's quite big in person.
Mm-hmm.
And I think even just down to 40, where they have a Datejust, and of course they have Datejusts that go smaller, but something in the 36 to 40 millimeter space. And like, I don't think we're necessarily going to see this, but 36 to 40 and fully steel.
Yeah.
So like essentially I'm asking for the cheapest version of the Skydweller.
Yeah.
Would be very fun. I think it's such a cool name. It's an incredibly cool complication set that other brands aren't doing. And it's absolutely worth taking a closer look. But I do think the 42, when I see them, I always think like, that's a pretty big watch.
Yeah.
On any wrist.
And it looks big. It looks big. I mean, every time I see pictures of it, it just looks like a chunky big watch.
Yeah.
So
I think it'd be really cool to see them bring out the next generation of the Skydweller and offer it in more than one size, especially because their whole website is all about, you know, kind of configuring watches.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah.
Like you go in and you kind of pick your size for Datejust and then the dial color and the this and the that. And I think that would align nicely with the Skydweller. But like imagine for me, if you will, a steel version that still has the cool bezel design function, all that kind of thing, black dial maybe, or it could be a white dial or whatever, blue, a nice blue dial, but something that really from 10 feet away looks largely like a Datejust, I think would be quite a compelling piece of product for them.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, good pick.
All right, so that's four guesses and two wishes for Rolex. Mm-hmm. Let's follow it up with Tudor. Do you want to go first?
Sure, yeah. I mean, you know, you talked about briefly about Tudor and Rolex with regard to Formula One.
Yeah, we're on the same page largely for them.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Tudor, given that they announced their partnership in Formula One, you know, sponsoring a team, the photos that were shown of the drivers wearing black bays just didn't quite sit right with me. I was like, okay, you know, dive watches on drivers felt a little bit kind of phoned in, and I thought this is a case where they're holding their cards. They're waiting for a big event like, you know, Watches and Wonders to release something really Formula One related. And I think it'll be something in like, you know, we've talked about this, I believe, in a Q&A or maybe the Slack Q&A, you know, like a carbon case, Pelagos chronograph, like what they did with the Alinghi Red Bull team. I think, look, you've got the Red Bull connection. You've got a really sporty, very sort of cutting edge technology in terms of case materials. In a chronograph, which makes perfect sense for motorsports. I'm not sure they would use the Pelagos as the base for that. Maybe it would be a carbon cased, oh, I don't know, Black Bay chrono or something. But I just feel like they've got to do something modern. You know, what was that watch they did years ago, a few years back? It was
the Fast Rider?
The Fast Rider, yeah.
Yeah, ceramic.
Ceramic, right.
Ceramic
so, you know, they have history with
that was a partnership with Ducati.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I could see them doing something, you know, in sort of that vein. So
yeah. Yeah, yeah.
We'll see. But yeah, that's my first prediction.
Yeah, I mean, like both of mine basically align very deeply with yours. First, I think we'll see a quote unquote production version of the watch that Daniel Ricciardo is photographed wearing, which appears to be a bright blue dialed ceramic Black Bay.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's a big pitch. I think that's something people, literally when the watch came out, people were saying like, eventually we'll see this.
Yeah.
And I think we probably will to some extent. And I think if you're going to make a watch with this F1 tie, I agree that the Black Bay is a weird home. The ceramic makes it feel more Formula One, like with an advanced material.
Mm-hmm.
But deep down, while I do think we may see a blue dial RB Visa Cash App ceramic Black Bay a la Daniel Ricciardo, great title. I think at the same time, I do think that we might see a modern take on a chronograph for motorsports.
Yeah, yeah.
I know how general that sounds. That's very similar to what you said. I'm in full agreement. I think that it could be something like a carbon heritage chronograph.
Mm-hmm.
I think it could be something like you said, like a version of the Pelagos that is less for sailing and more for racing in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a bunch, there's obviously about two dozen ways you could go about this, like aligning a product from their catalog with Formula One. But in my mind, it kind of needs to be a chronograph unless they're worried about the Daytona connection.
Oh yeah.
But the brand does not have a Daytona.
Right, right.
You know, the Black Bay chronograph could be a great home for a carbon case, or maybe we see a ceramic version of that. And this the ceramic one that the team has been wearing is like a hint towards now we'll have a ceramic Black Bay chronograph for Visa RB Cash App. I'm not really sure. I mean, obviously, we're not sure. We just flat out don't know. And I'd be like, well, obviously, we've got friends at the brand. I don't even ask. They can't say.
Right, right.
You know, we're 2-3 days after the Australian Grand Prix, and Yuki Tsunoda did quite well. A great, you know, he was in the points, which you can't really complain about. And so I think yeah, there's some buttons they can push there. If it was totally, I think the like down the middle option would be, yeah, something with a cool carbon case that they haven't done before that can connect very deeply with this, you know, run into Formula One.
Yeah.
So what have you got? You got another one? You got a wish? What are you feeling?
Another prediction, I think, you know, given kind of Tudor's playbook or track record with the way they spin out versions of their watches, I feel like it's only a matter of time before we see like a Pelagos Dark, you know, whether it's the Pelagos 39 or the FXD. I mean, we've seen Tom Place get his FXD Pelagos DLC coded, as did Watches of Espionage, and they look just amazing.
Yeah. They do.
I feel like there's got to be an official version coming. It's a natural fit for it, whether it is the FXD or, you know, the big Pelagos or the 39 like you have. I think they'll call it. I believe it would be called the Pelagos Dark if they stick to their naming conventions. If that's kind of the route they go, as they did with the Black Bay collection, they did, you know, Black Bay Dark, and then I think the Black Bay Black was just a black dial. I get confused about the dark versus black in their collection, but. I think it'll be a Pelagos Dark is where I'm going.
I wouldn't be surprised if we see some sort of an expansion of the Pelagos 39.
Mm, yeah.
So I don't disagree with that. Whether it's maybe it's a blue dial to go with the larger of the blue. Maybe it's a 39 LHD, which would be very cool.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And would just follow the playbook.
Yeah.
So I think that makes it more of a prediction, certainly. You know, for me, I think I can move on to the wish. Obviously, for years, we've talked about the Pelagos GMT, which I don't know that we'll ever see. I would argue like they might actually be missing the moment if it didn't happen this year GMTs.
Yeah, yeah.
If you really wanted to make the hype play, the one that, and I've talked about it before, and this is going to be my prediction for Hodinkee, so you'll see a render of it in the next week or so on the site, but it's a 36 millimeter Ranger with a 12 hour bezel. That's my wish.
Wow.
Yeah. If I'm trying to think of Tudors, I would actually turn around and like immediately text Cole and be like, all right, how do I get on a list?
Yeah.
I don't need to be first, but I'd like to register my interest
to
buy one of these.
Yeah.
36 millimeter Ranger. Or it could be, I mean, arguably it could be the 39 with a bezel, I think would balance out a little nicer. 39 wouldn't bother me.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a Ranger with a 12 hour bezel would be a genuinely interesting, fun thing. It would be cool. You could call it the Ranger 2, which would be like a nod of another generation, but also two time zones. I think that's it's the best functionality for a field watch is a 12-hour bezel. And I think that the brand could really make like a watch that would suddenly kind of command a category.
Yeah, I like that. I think it'd be really cool. I'm really warming up to the Ranger line in general. I love the look of the Ranger. I'm not sure it's a watch I could own, but given my proclivities for bezels and pushers and things, but...
And you already have a 14.27.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
It's probably more likely that we see just a 36 millimeter version of the current.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think a 12 hour bezel's at all likely, which is why it's in the wish.
Right.
But I think it'd be awfully cool.
Yeah.
I think it'd be awfully cool. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'll kind of wrap things up, and I think, you know, you touched on it as well, and I think it's a watch we both would love to see, and that is some you know, rejuvenation of the Heritage chronograph that was kind of Tudor's re-entry into the North American market, you know, back in whatever it was, 2012 or some thereabouts.
Speaking of 12-hour bezels.
Yeah, exactly. What a cool watch. And I think now, you know, they've got a proven track record with like an in-house chronograph movement from the Black Bay Chrono and, you know, move that over to the Heritage Chrono, make it a little slimmer, maybe, you know, refine the sizing. What a cool watch. I mean, I've always loved that watch. I loved the black and orange. I loved the blue. And, you know, they could just kind of refine that and re-release it. It's definitely a very iconic watch from their heritage, you know, going back to the 70s.
Absolutely.
And would fit nicely into their lineup. And I think, you know, if that's what makes its way into the, you know, the things we talked about with Tudor in terms of playing up their Formula One interactions, all the better. So anyway, big wish there. We'll see.
And then, I mean, just for simple clarity, because just to avoid the comments, we are aware that the Black Bay Chrono doesn't use a strictly in-house movement. It's a Breitling sourced movement. But obviously the brand, especially with the new manufacturer that launched last year, I don't think it's outside the scope of what they're capable of to make a chronograph movement. So I don't disagree. It'd be neat to see them claim that as another manufacturer element. To have that, and then you have to assume if part of that business is selling movements to other brands, mm-hmm. that they want a chronograph.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
So very cool. Yeah. I agree. I like all those. I'm always pumped. Tudor's the one I'm most excited about. It'll be 8:30 a.m. on the 9th in Geneva. I will be sitting at the hotel, just frantically refreshing my computer. super pumped to see what they come out with. Even if it is quote unquote a slow year or a light year, I think they're still going to have something interesting. And then they've just been, quote unquote, firing on all cylinders for the last few years, mm-hmm. with a lot of really interesting releases. And I don't know that I think it would be hard to top the 54. This year.
Yeah, true.
From last year. And arguably, I'd say they don't have to, but I think we're right in thinking that the home, we could be dead wrong, to be clear. We'll see. And we'll talk about it after the show for sure. But I do think that the home of some focus of this year will be the Formula One connection.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if it doesn't happen at Watches and Wonders, I think that'll be strange, but it would hint that there'll be something bigger coming later in the F1 season. Mm-hmm. We're only three races in. So there's still plenty of time to announce stuff and that sort of thing.
Yeah, last year felt like a real dive watch year for them with the FXD launch that we attended, and then of course the Black Bay 54 and refinements of the other Black Bays. So yeah, you're right. This feels like an F1 year for them, like a chronograph motorsports kind of year. We'll see. And we'll certainly wrap all this up after the show. I think that it's one of my favorite episodes, is kind of rehashing everything the week after Watches and Wonders dies down.
Yeah, totally. Just to reiterate what we said before, we will not have an episode the week of the show, so that's the week of April 8th. But we'll be back with an episode recapping the show for April 18th. So give us a little bit of leeway on the timeline there. We have daily podcasts coming from Hodinkee, so if you're looking for watch content, watch discussions, I'm sure I'll be on at least a couple of those episodes. By all means, check that out. It'll be on hodinkee.com. But TGN will take a little break. So we'll have an episode on the 4th. We won't have a show on the 11th, and we will have a show on the 18th. I hope that's super clear. And we'll see. I mean, I think every year we've been wrong, so I don't have to feel bad. I think that you can expect our guesses to be probably mostly wrong, which is part of the fun. But we'll recap everything from Tudor to Rolex to Doxa to every brand that we get to touch on that we love. So seeing as many of those sorts of brands as possible, I'm super pumped to see Zin, as always.
Yeah,
it should be a great show. I am talking quickly because I'm very stressed about it going well. So it's been a very stressful couple of weeks trying to get everything ready for this. But look, I think that's a pretty solid one. We got a few minutes left for final notes. You want to jump in? You've got two, so feel free to go first.
I do have two. People may have seen in the kind of the outdoor press in the past week or so that a woman by the name of Jasmine Paris, who's from Scotland, became the first woman to finish this obscure and very grueling endurance race called the Barclay Marathon. And mm-hmm. I had never heard of it. As I kind of went down the rabbit hole about this race, I find it utterly sadistic and incredibly fascinating. This is a foot race put on in kind of the mountainous terrain in Tennessee. There's a state park there called Frozen Head that's kind of in the wilderness there, surrounding, of all things, a state prison, a maximum security prison. And the Barclay Marathon was inspired by a prison break by the man who shot Martin Luther King Jr. And it led to a manhunt in those same mountains. And the founder of this Barclay Marathon thumbed his nose at James Earl Ray, who escaped, and said, he was wandering out in the woods for over a day and he only managed to get 8 miles away. He said, I could do 100. And that led to the creation of this race that is very obscure, very strange. It's $1.60 to enter. They only take 40 or 50 people. Some years, nobody finishes. It involves navigating through the woods, incredible, double the height of Everest in terms of elevation gain. You have to find books in the woods and tear out the page with your race number to bring back and prove that you did the route correctly. Very strange, very grueling. And in my kind of looking into this, I came across this documentary film from 2014 called The Barkley Marathons, The Race That Eats Its Young. And you can rent it various places, but I found it in its entirety on YouTube. And it's great. It's a great film. And it'll leave you like awestruck by the people that managed to finish this. It's just utterly, you know, as someone who's training for what I consider a fairly difficult endurance event in a couple of months, like this just blows it away. I mean, it's just incredible. So yeah, check it out. Really, really fascinating.
Yeah. Back when that doc first came out, I remember getting pretty obsessed with the Barkley. I guess this must have been just before we started the show, because I don't think we ever talked about it on the show.
Yeah, I don't think so.
I mean, it's definitely among the most insane organized races in existence.
Yeah.
Typically, lately, it's been, I believe, for the last hour, I believe they ran it first in 86. Mm-hmm. And it's usually around this time of year. So as you see, they just finished it. And it's always 100 miles, but it's done in 5 laps, almost like the petals of a flower.
Yeah.
It's absolute insanity. So like, I mean, world record is 52 hours, 3 minutes, 8 seconds, which is 2012. And then Jasmine set in at 59, 58, 21. I highly recommend reading and watching anything you can get about it, because it just gets crazier. The registration is always very strange. Like Jason said, it's $1.60 to apply. Sometimes they only allow you, like, it'll be registration is open for one day. Sometimes you have to submit a pack of cigarettes as part of the fee. It's all these sort of crazy sorts of things. License plates, I believe, were a submission factor for some time, like license plates from your state or whatever. It's a really, really genuinely fascinating, truly insane sort of ultra marathon. And all ultra marathons are crazy, but these are like Jason said, like borderline completely masochistic.
Yeah.
Super impressive that that Jasmine was able to finish it. Just completely insane.
With 90 seconds to spare, because the cutoff is 60 hours. Yep. I mean, just yeah, truly amazing. Yeah, yeah. Good stuff.
Highly recommend you dig into it. But my pick this week is actually a very self-serving one. Just a few minutes ago, as we were recording, we launched a Talking Watches that I'm exceedingly proud of. It is live now on the site. Maybe by the time this episode comes out, many of you will have watched it. But it's with Hurley Haywood, who's an American race car driver. He won Daytona 5 times. He won Le Mans 3 times. He won Sebring twice. He has titles in a couple other championships, like different cars, IndyCar, that sort of thing. I've known of Hurley, and we met once back in 2017. And then I got the option earlier this year to go down to Jacksonville, Florida, just back in January, for those of you who follow my travel and what we talk about on the show, to chat with Hurley at the Brumos Collection. He raced with the Brumos team for much of his career. What's notable about Hurley beyond his incredible, like arguably the greatest endurance race car driver of all time, or at least in the running, certainly from the American context, is he has a 50-year history of being, aligned with both Rolex and Porsche, two of the most notable, you know, brands in the world, regardless, certainly watches and cars, but also in the racing world. And just a fascinating, really kind, incredibly talented guy with some of the coolest, like, race won watches I've ever come across. He was lovely. We had a great day together, and I think the video came out really well.
Amazing. Yeah, I'm going to watch this right after we click off. You're right. This published as we were recording, because I looked before we started and it wasn't up, and I'm scrolling through right now. This speaking of Rolex dress watches, this Cellini that he got as a gift from Rolex is a pretty wild watch, isn't it? Wow.
Absolutely wild. Quartz Cellini with hinged hooded lugs.
Jeez.
It's I believe the reference is a 6633, wow. But knowing me, it could be a 3366.
Wow, amazing.
Not a four, no brain for 4-digit numbers, sadly.
Yeah,
no, it's great. I mean, it's majority of it's Rolex, obviously because of his career, but there's a story in there that you really need. I don't want to give it away. I didn't give it away in the text, but one of the watches, and it was the one that he was wearing, that he wore to the shoot and left with, was this 16220 Datejust, white dial Datejust with Roman numerals. Mm. And the background story from this one is really, really good. I highly recommend it. It involves a Timex that he shouldn't have been wearing, a phone call from the president of Rolex, and all this kind of stuff. It's really fun stuff.
Oh, that's great. Super cool.
Huge fan. And it's one of those ones where, like, I showed up and it was almost like zero work to do the whole video.
Oh, yeah.
My team was incredible. Joe and Jonathan shot this one. They had been hanging out with Hurley for the last couple of days because they went to the 24 Hours of Daytona with him, where he still is like a huge figurehead in the sport.
Yeah.
And it was just a great experience wall to wall. And genuinely, I would say that about 99% of time in my career, when a piece of content comes out, all I feel is relief that it's done.
Mm-hmm.
Never, I'm very seldom proud of it or feel like I want to, you know, pat myself on the back or that sort of thing. But with this, I'm pretty happy of how we were able to capture Hurley especially, but there's a lot of like archival footage in the video. It's really nicely, the team did a great job. I'm not saying I necessarily did a great job. Hurley was awesome and my team did a great job and the video came out really well. So check that out if that sounds interesting, if you're either into the watch side or the automotive side. And I assume if you're listening to this, you might be both. But it's a goodie, and I had a blast getting a chance to do it.
Can't wait to see it. Congrats. That was great. I remember when you went down there, it was like less than a 24-hour trip. I mean, you were there and back. And
in Florida for like 18 hours.
Wow.
All right, your next one?
Yeah, speaking of Porsche and Rolex and watches in general, my buddy Paul Andrews, who actually designed the covers for both of my novels, he's a London-based graphic designer, very talented guy. He launched his own website selling some of his designs on T-shirts, largely motorsports and horology themed. It's called Modern Thrills, and it's modern-thrills.com. And I'm encouraging people to check it out. I actually ordered a couple of shirts from him the day he launched it, and just wanted to kind of spread the word because it's great stuff. He's got a real knack for kind of wink, wink, sort of tongue in cheek designs that play on sort of nicknames of kind of well-known Porsche cars, you know, whale tails, et cetera. As well as, one of my favorites, one of the shirts I ordered is actually, you know, the back of Paul Newman's Daytona where Joanne Woodward had inscribed drive carefully. He changed it slightly to dive carefully in the same typeface. So like it's total inside baseball, like this sort of stuff.
Yeah, that's great.
He's got one with like a Regatta timer sort of aperture, kind of a nod to that style of watch, et cetera. So really, really cool stuff. Always my t-shirt drawer is already overflowing with great designs and fun shirts. And I can't wait to get these couple that I ordered from him and add to my collection. So check it out. Congrats, Paul, on launching that.
Very cool. Yeah. Love a good t-shirt. And, I scanned through some of these when you added it to the show notes and, the, like you said, the kind of tongue in cheek inside joke sort of thing is great.
Yeah. Yeah. Great.
Well, look, that's an episode. We're over an hour. I got to get to, editing this and getting it all ready so we can keep on pace for what's going to be, you know, the busiest couple weeks of the year. But looking forward to seeing you in Geneva pretty soon. We've got one more episode before that we take a week break. We've got a great guest lined up that we're both very excited about.
Mm-hmm.
And just a big thank you to the crew for handling the recent drama as well as they did. And it worked out nicely, thankfully. And looking forward to having BST come back better, bigger and better than ever. And if you're keen on being part of the show, check it out at thegraynato.com. You can support us there and get into the Slack as well. Beyond that, thank you so much for listening. And music throughout is Siesta by Jazzar via the Free Music Archive.
And we leave you with this quote from Abraham Lincoln, who said, "The best way to predict the future is to create it."